Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now. But if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic full zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right, betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figured that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie. Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Helper.
And I am the other host, Aaron Matte. How are you, Katie?
I'm good. You?
I'm great. Having a good summer?
Yeah, I'm a little overly air-conditioned right now. It's a little cold where I am.
You poor thing.
I know. That's very...
Shout out to all our viewers watching who have no AC at all.
I know. Should we cut this out? Am I going to get canceled as a...
It's okay.
AC imperialist? Yeah. I can't work without AC though, so...
It's tough. I mean, especially in this East Coast heat, it's tough.
Well, thank God we have the Inflation Reduction Act. That's going to not do a lot for the climate.
Yeah, that's right. Or I just learned this from David Dayen at the American Prospect that, you know, how one of the big achievements of the act was that Democrats finally are going to accomplish a long time goal of negotiating drug prices, right? Using the government's power to negotiate drug prices. Well, it's only going to apply to a very small number of drugs, and they're not going to kick in. These negotiations are not going to kick in for at least 2 or 3 years. So many seniors right now who could really benefit from this, unfortunately, some people might not live to see the benefits.
Yeah.
So great job, Democrats.
Yeah, go Dems. Yeah. Every piece of legislation from the Dems is basically Democrats suck.
Well, speaking of Democrats suck.
All right, let's get into it. Should we do the four basic food groups?
Yeah.
Let's go to the videotape. I got Democrats suck, so let's just go to the videotape.
The Biden administration's ruled out releasing roughly $7 billion in foreign assets held by Afghanistan's central bank on U.S. soil. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which reports Biden's decision not to return the funds came after he ordered the assassination of Al-Qaeda's leader in Kabul. This comes as the United Nations warns a staggering 95% of Afghans are not getting enough food, with that number rising to almost 100% in female-headed households. Earlier this year, Democracy Now! Spoke with Masuda Sultan, Afghan-American women's rights activist.
Human Rights Watch agrees with us. The head of the UN agrees with us. The head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, agrees with us. You talk to just about every humanitarian organization, any economist, they will tell you that a central bank's reserves belong in the central bank. But instead, we have just decided that Afghanistan cannot have its central bank reserves, that that economy will now be crippled. We just knocked the legs out of it, and the humanitarian crisis will just grow and grow. Afghanistan will be an aid-dependent country.
Masouda Soltan is founding member of Unfreezing Afghanistan.
What kind of sadist does this? Refuses to release $7 billion of frozen Afghan assets.
It's a sadist who waged a 20-year military occupation, knew from the start that it was losing. In fact, sabotaged the best chance it had at winning back when it could have negotiated with the Taliban. But Donald Rumsfeld, the genius, said, no, we don't negotiate with terrorists. So that led to a prolonged insurgency and led ultimately to the U.S.'s humiliating withdrawal a year ago. And now, because the U.S. was humiliated, the people of Afghanistan have to suffer even more by being denied of their own resources, their own money.
And the UN is saying that 95% of Afghans are not getting enough to eat. It's disgusting.
20 million people, which is half the population, are suffering either level 3 crisis or a level 4 emergency levels of food insecurity, according to the World Food Program. Over 1 million children under 5 are suffering from prolonged acute malnutrition. That's according to, again, the World Food Program. And the U.S. is helping by withholding billions of dollars of their government's own money.
So Ned Price at the State Department says, the presence of Ayman al-Zawahiri on Afghan soil with the knowledge of senior members of the Haqqani Taliban network only reinforces the deep concerns that we have regarding the potential diversion of such funds to terrorist groups. So right now we're looking at mechanisms that could be put in place to see to it that these $3.5 billion in preserved assets make their way efficiently and effectively to the people of Afghanistan in a way that doesn't make them ripe for diversion to terrorist groups or elsewhere.
Yeah, there's a thing in international law called collective punishment, where you don't punish entire populations to achieve war aims. And in this case, to, you know, purportedly go after al-Qaeda, and the allegation is that Taliban was harboring this al-Qaeda leader, so the whole population has to suffer. It sounds like a war crime to me.
Yeah.
And it's also something that the U.S. is completely hypocritical on, because the U.S. has harbored terrorists before, like the people who blew up Cuban airliners and killed civilians, and the generals and Nazis from around the world that the U.S. harbored after the Second World War. The fact that right now the U.S. essentially supports the leadership of al-Qaeda in Syria, because al-Qaeda right now controls Syria's last rebel-held province of Idlib, and that's controlled by a group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is just a new name for al-Qaeda in Syria. It's led by this guy, Muhammad al-Jalani, who is a former deputy of Zawahiri. He was actually sent to Syria by al-Qaeda. And the U.S., because the U.S. has used al-Qaeda in its regime change war against Syria, the U.S. is fine with Jalani controlling an entire province in Syria. And he basically has that province under the protection of Turkey, which is a U.S. ally in NATO. So completely hypocritical. No reason why the Afghan people should suffer a day longer just because one elderly al-Qaeda leader was living in Kabul. And of course, they were doing this. The U.S. was doing this to Afghanistan even before Zawahiri was killed.
Right, right. Yeah, it's ex post facto.
Yeah.
Justification, yeah. Anyway, if Trump were doing this, a lot of Biden fans would be rightfully disgusted and calling it out.
That's right.
But Biden's doing it, so it's not a war crime. It's just, I don't know what, tough decisions, hard choices.
All right. Well, so for Republicans suck, we have a Republican who very much is on board with the Biden administration's policies in Afghanistan and pretty much any other country that's been the target of U.S. regime change and military occupations. And that's Liz Cheney, who just lost her primary race in Wyoming, defeated by a Trump supporter who basically ran against Cheney on the platform of the fact that Cheney went against Trump over the whole January 6th thing. But Liz Cheney is now talking about possibly running for president in 2024. She dropped a hint in her concession speech.
The great and original champion of our party, Abraham Lincoln, was defeated in elections for the Senate and the House before he won the most important election of all. Lincoln ultimately prevailed. He saved our union, and he defined our obligation as Americans for all of history. Speaking at Gettysburg of the great task remaining before us, Lincoln said that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth.
Whoa, the humility there.
Yeah, look, so this is a, there's a lot of Republican suckiness going around here. You know, in fairness to Liz Cheney, and I gag a little bit saying those words, she was targeted because she did stand up to Trump's lies about having his election stolen. So, you know, fair enough. But the thing is, Liz Cheney doesn't care about democracy or integrity. Liz Cheney only cares that Trump humiliated her wing of the party when he ran in 2016. He basically destroyed the Bush and Cheney dynasties. He called them out on the campaign trail for the Iraq War. And since then, the Cheneys have been on a revenge mission against him. They also just don't like he's bad for their brand. Their brand is regime change. Trump supports those policies. He carried them out. But he's too honest when he talks about, for example, stealing oil from Syria. You weren't supposed to say that. You're supposed to be like Dick Cheney and say that we're there to spread democracy and find missing WMDs. So that's the source of her dispute with Trump. And really, policy-wise, did the Cheneys ever stand up to Trump? No, they actually voted with him constantly. And there's a tweet here showing just some of this. So this is from Kasim Rashid on Twitter. He says, FYI, Liz Cheney opposed the Voting Rights Act, minimum wage increase, the Equality Act, Equal Rights Amendment, the George Floyd Act, Build Back Better, Infrastructure Bill, Inflation Reduction Act, the $35 insulin bill, Women's Health Protection Act, anti-gas price gouging bill, and voted with Trump 93% of the time, and is also a unhinged militarist who supports every single regime change operation, supports torture, worked under the Bush administration to help destabilize the Middle East in furtherance of her father's agenda. And Republicans are in a state where none of those issues matter. It's just the fact that she went against Trump on his Stop the Steal scam. And luckily, though, for Liz Cheney fans, she's hinting there in that speech that she'll be running in 2024. And my question is, will she be doing this as a Republican where she's no longer really welcome, or as a Democrat where she's now treated as a hero? She's like worshipped every single day on MSNBC and CNN. So stay tuned.
So is that why it's a Democrat suck? Because she's become a hero for Democrats?
Well, so often, Katie, I mean, as you know well, so many Republicans suck and Democrats suck. And always be interchanged for the other.
Right. It's a fine line. Yeah. I like the way she compares herself to Abraham Lincoln.
I wonder if in the Civil War, which side? I have to wonder. Liz Cheney would be on.
Also, she very much pushed back against Trump trying to pull out of Afghanistan.
That's right. That's one of those rare occasions when Trump tries to do something sensible.
Right.
Again, I stress very rare. But yes, she sabotaged that along with members of the CIA who leaked fake claims about Russian bounties being put on U.S. troops. And Liz Cheney was a major driver of that.
Right. All right. Well, for Isn't That Weird, I have a story. We can just click on this. It's an interesting story, and people should see the visuals. So reading at People magazine, Velveeta releases cheese-infused martini that's garnished with pasta shells. It's good news for cheese lovers. On Wednesday, Velveeta released their own unique spin on a dirty martini, the Veltini, made with Velveeta-infused vodka. The brand teamed up with BLT Restaurant Group for the unconventional creation. Select locations of the steakhouse chain will offer the martini for $15 during golden hour from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., but the cheesy cocktail won't be around for too long. It's only available for a limited time and while supplies last. While the savory beverage features Velveeta's signature cheese flavors through the flavored vodka, it also blends in olive brine and vermouth. The garnishes elevate the cheese theme even further. The Veltini will be topped with Velveeta stuffed olives and jumbo Velveeta shells and cheese, all complete with a cheese dip rim. You know how you just said that Democrats suck and Republicans suck are often almost interchangeable? For me, this is could have been Isn't That Terrible. Wilson, can we just show the image? So I'm someone who, I don't know about you, Aaron, I love dirty martinis when they're not made with cheese. I love a dirty martini with vodka. I'll take a gin, but I prefer vodka. So a dirty martini, for people who don't know, is a martini with a lot of olive and olive juice. or olive brine. But this is an assault, I think, on the dirty martini. I mean, I also really don't like a lot of cheeses, and in fact, I think that there are blue cheese stuffed olives. I don't know if you know about that, which scares me. I've had very bad. I once bit into what I thought was a ranch dressing, and it was a blue cheese dressing, and I feel like I'm still not over it. It was like
ranch and blue cheese are not for everybody. I stay away from both.
Both, interesting. Well, I like ranch, but I cannot deal with blue cheese. I really feel like there's you know how people overuse that word violence, but for me, it really is violence.
Yeah.
When my mouth is subjected to blue cheese.
Yeah. But you do like ranch. That's interesting.
I do like ranch. Ranch. They have a creamy, it has a teeny bit of kick, but not the kick that blue cheese has. Blue cheese, and I know people who I respect because they like blue cheese, but they get how gross it would be if you don't like it. Mm-hmm. So that's my, isn't that weird, Veltinis.
That's very weird. That's very weird. If anybody orders a Veltini, please let us know how it is.
Yeah, use the hashtag usefulidiotspod.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? I mean, I had so many options this week for Republican suck that I just had to use this for Isn't That Terrible. This is a story out of Mississippi. Check what the governor of Mississippi has to say. So this is Governor Tate Reeves of Mississippi, and this is what he says in a new post. And he quotes Ronald Reagan, "Government programs once launched never disappear. Today, Mississippi, we are ending RAMP, a federal program that incentivizes people not to work by using taxpayer dollars to pay up for 15 months of free rent and utilities. RAMP was originally intended to help those struggling as a direct result of COVID. Yet like so many other government programs on Democrats' wish lists, it fundamentally lost its way and no longer serves its original purpose. Mississippians pay enough for their own rent. They shouldn't have to pay for others too." So what he's doing here is basically Mississippi got federal money, not state money, federal money to help people pay their rent in the COVID era. And there's still millions of dollars left in that funding package that Mississippi got from the federal government. This governor, Reeves, is returning the money to Washington. It's not even state money. It's federal money he's returning to Washington. So basically he's telling residents of his own state, sorry, we're not gonna help you. We're not gonna let the federal government help you pay your rent. We're giving it back to the government. So whatever, they can presumably spend more money on Raytheon and Lockheed Martin to send off to Ukraine.
And I like the way he tries to shame people and also imply that it's like Mississippians pay enough for rent. They shouldn't have to pay for other people's. Well, what about the people who can't pay their rent who are Mississippians?
According to Reeves' office, there's $130 million remaining in this fund. That's a lot of money. And this is at a time when last year there was a survey that found that more than 60% of people polled were worried about facing eviction or foreclosure. So at this time, when Reeves could be using the money that he's already been given to help these people, he's giving it back.
That's so disgusting. That is genuinely terrible. What's not terrible is that we have a great show for you coming up.
Yes, we do. We are going to be joined by Chairman Omali Yeshitela. He is chair of the African People's Socialist Party. And he was recently raided by the FBI before Trump was. That's the raid that's getting a lot of attention right now, the Trump raid. But this raid happened in late July.
He was a trendsetter before it was cool.
Yeah. And the story is crazy. And very few people are talking about the story when they really should. So we're going to hear from him about what happened in that raid and about, you know, his broader history of political activism as a Black liberation activist in this country.
So let's go to the interview with Omali Yeshitela. So excited to be talking to Omali Yeshitela, who is the chairman of the African Socialist International and the African People's Socialist Party. He founded the Burning Spear newspaper in 1968, which still exists. He's been a longtime advocate for reparations and participated in the International Tribunal on Reparations for African People, which was held in Brooklyn, New York in 1982. And he founded the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement in 1991. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Can you just start off by telling us what happened, recounting what happened on the early morning of July 29th?
Yes. On that morning, my wife and I were sitting at the dining room table preparing for the day. It was 5 o'clock in the morning when we were talking about things, and there was a doula class that was being organized, that had been organized, and that would be occurring at our center, the Uhura House here in St. Louis, where 20 young African women were being trained to be doulas. It's part of the overall Black Power Blueprint project that we have here in St. Louis, in a city where something like there are enough Black babies that die in the first year of life to fill 15 kindergarten classrooms every year. So that's one of the projects that we were taking on, and we were talking about that. She had to get to the Uhura House. She was overseeing this project. And I was actually preparing to go to the gym. So we were just sitting and talking about things. And suddenly, out of the night, this loud, booming voice saying that we should come out, the people who were in this residence should come out with our hands empty and our hands up. And this is the FBI. And at first it was startling, and we weren't quite sure if this message was directed at us or not, because occasionally if there's something like a tornado coming through, you'll hear this sound that comes out, warnings, et cetera. So we were not sure what it was we were hearing right away. And the voice continued to come, and they actually used the specific address and said that people should come out with our hands up and our hands empty. So, and that this is the FBI. Explosions began to happen all around the house. These flashbang grenades were going off, and I was to learn later that they had actually penetrated into the back stairwell in the house and had detonated these flashbang grenades in the stairwell. And but I didn't know at the time where it was coming from. And so I asked my wife, who's also a leader in our movement, to let me go down first, and she should get on the phone to contact people, let them know what was happening, that we were being raided. And she tried, but unsuccessful, because they had jammed our phones, so we couldn't communicate with anybody. So I went down the stairs, and as soon as I was exiting the stairwell, in front of the house, there was this armored vehicle, and I could see these camouflage-wearing FBI agents, and I don't know who else there, and bouncing off my chest or hitting me in the chest were several of these laser dots that comes from automatic weapons. So I was sure that they were going to kill me at that moment. And my wife was following me out of the house. And as I opened the door for her to come down the stairs, a drone passed over her head going up the stairwell into the house. So there was a command to come this way, come this way. And we walked toward the person who was making the command, who seemed to be somebody with some authority. I was told to put my hands behind my back. They zip tied me. My wife, when she came down, they put handcuffs on her. They wanted us to sit on the curb outside, and something that we didn't do. And so I'm, and all the time this is going on, these flashbang grenades are still going off around the house, and perhaps in the house, in the stairwell of the house. They would break windows. They would knock the doors in. And I'm asking, what is this about? And they said that we have a search warrant. And I asked to see the search warrant. The answer was, well, I don't have it, but someone over here has it in some place in the vicinity. Why is this happening? They said that later this morning, some indictment is going to be issued in Tampa, Florida, for a Russian national. And should he ever come to the United States, he would be arrested. At the same time, although I didn't know it, the office of the African People's Solidarity Committee, which is the Solidarity Front of our party, which is comprised of white people, mostly, who do work in 130 some odd cities and 30 states in the United States around reparations and taking the struggle of African people, that's their work, into the white communities. That center recently opened in South St. Louis, which is the majority white section of St. Louis, was raided. They use battering rams and knock the doors in. They use the flashbang grenades. They tape the video cameras to make sure that they were not seen, their activities were not recorded, although they didn't succeed absolutely. And upstairs, there's an apartment. They went to the apartment upstairs, two young apart members of our organization. White people were there. They were handcuffed. They were at gunpoint, held at gunpoint. And then across town, the homes of Penny Hess and Kitty Riley, two other members, white people who support us and are part of our movement and organization, their house was raided again, you know, knocking doors in and holding them at gunpoint. And they took, in each of these places, they took all of our devices, our cell phones, our laptops, our iPads, anything like that. They tons and tons of information, obviously, you know, like on these devices they have captured. And so at the same time in St. Petersburg, Florida, as this was going on, Eastern time, which would have been 6 o'clock there, they went to the Uhuru House in St. Petersburg, Florida. They used battering rams and knocked the doors in. There, they took our radio off the air for a while. They stole all kinds of devices, materials from our archives, et cetera, executing what they said was a search warrant. And they blocked off an entire city block in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I guess they did that in part because in 1996, a local county, state, and federal forces attacked that same building. This time, they didn't use the same excuse, but they had the local government had murdered a 17-year-old young man there, and the government saw us as primary organizers against that and organizing the community. So, and they had trapped me and several other members in that building. And they used all the tear gas in the city of St. Petersburg, Florida, on that building. They set houses afire in the African community. They tried to set our building afire using these tear gas canisters that actually can set fires. And they set fires in the trees behind the building, et cetera. That was in 1996. And I expected to die in that one, and I think would have died. This was, if you remember, fresh in the minds of everybody was what had happened to MOVE in 1985, I think it was, in Philadelphia, because in addition to all of those troops outside, 300 strong, there was also light planes and a helicopter that was also deployed, and the community came out and fought them in the streets and actually forced the helicopter down in 1996 with gunfire. So I'm assuming that's part of what inspired them to block off the entire community so that people couldn't come to the Uhuru House when they made that attack at 6 o'clock in the morning there. And then they went to the residence of this incredible young leader, Akilia Nai, who is the one that oversees our information production and distribution from the radios, from the newspaper that we have, from publications, et cetera. They went to her residence and they told her that this time the St. Petersburg Police Department knocked on the door, inquired if she were Akile, and then told her that someone had broken into her car, and that she should come out. And she came outside to look inside her car. And that's when the FBI came from behind, vans, et cetera. And they used that. They stole her cell phone, et cetera. And so that's more or less how things happened. So you had this two-state assault, just the most ridiculous, asinine kinds of insinuation about why it was that they did this. And And while I can't talk, you know, like about the specifics of that, because even this discussion that we're having now is something that they will use to construct a narrative that fits these ridiculous charges that they have imposed on us. I can tell you this for sure, that the charges are bogus and that nothing that they are claiming that we did is something that we haven't done since the founding of the African People's Socialist Party itself in 1972. And since my activism, which preceded that, by almost a decade. In fact, the African People's Socialist Party did experience a 50th anniversary in May of this year. So it's all bogus, it's nonsense, but it's insidious because this is the same FBI that integrated itself for the purpose of more than 100 years ago, for the purpose of infiltrating the movement led by Marcus Garvey. That's the first Black person they brought into the FBI was for the purpose of destroying the Garvey movement that had 11 million followers all around the world, especially in Africa. And of course, we know the history of Martin Luther King and how they hounded King and even tried to get him to commit suicide, the things they did to Malcolm X. And that's just Paul Robeson, who was brought before the House of Un-American Activities Committee. Were you ever a member of the Communist Party kind of garbage that, and you know, like Russia somehow has always, in most of this, except for Garvey, you know, there's this specter of Russia that's someplace being used because it's one problem that they have is the history that the United States government and most of Europe, the history that they have with Black people in Africa and every place else. So to say that we are continuing that war to maintain the captivity of Black people and to frustrate any effort that they may be making to be free, they're not fighting Black people, they're fighting Russians. And so rather than fight Russians in the real world in St. Petersburg, Russia, they're fighting Russia in the Black community of St. Petersburg, Florida, and in St. Louis, Missouri, which is absolutely ridiculous. And I think anybody can see through it, given an opportunity to do so. But they've been running this Russia thing for such a long period of time. And they've created this information silo so that most people, and the truth of the matter is that, generally speaking, Americans are politically the most backwards people in the world in terms of living right in the center, in the heart of the most oppressive system that exports oppression and exploitation all around the world, are most ignorant about what it is that this government does. And so they, Russia, one. And two, because there's this insidious assumption in the minds of most white people globally that African people are too stupid to know what our own interests are, to organize ourselves, that somebody else must have come and told us that we need to be free and that we are mistreated in the United States. So if you hear Black people saying something is happening to us bad, it's not because it's happening to us, it's because this is Russia actually talking through these Black people, and it's Russia talking to the people complaining about George Floyd, and it's Russia talking to the people complaining about the horrible conditions that we experience as a people. That is what they have constructed, and they rely on a tradition, a history of a mistreatment of African people and a collaboration too often with white people, and this notion that African people would be too stupid to understand our own significance and our own interests, that many people will be able, they will be able to confuse a lot of people into believing that the lie. And so it's a political attack that's been made on us, and the colonial law is what they're using to carry out a political attack. And that's the situation as we understand it.
And to clarify something, you have not been charged with anything, right?
No, but yes and no. I'm an unindicted co-conspirator. And there are three other persons who are unindicted co-conspirators. And the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, all of these organizations, it's implied that we are also co-conspirators. So it leaves the door open. First of all, there must be something wrong for the US government to say that we are co-conspirators. And no, we haven't been charged with anything. And if the really interesting thing about this is the man that they charged in Russia, should he come to the United States? Should he be put on trial? Should he be convicted? His sentence would be, if he got the maximum, 5 years. If I were convicted on what they said he made me do, the maximum sentence is 10 years. So I mean, it's just the most ridiculous thing. It's an attempt to crush the Black liberation movement and also the support, because what we've done, it's incredible. And I want to invite you. I want to invite people who are viewing this, come to St. Louis and see for yourself. I mean, because there's this implicit in this notion of being unindicted co-conspirators as this group lurking out there in the dark recesses of America that's making all this stuff happen. You come to St. Louis, see the Black Power Blueprint, see how we've transformed an entire African community in North St. Louis. Come to St. Petersburg, Florida. Go to Oakland, California. Go to Philadelphia, where we've created a farmer's One Africa, One Nation market that allows more than 100 vendors to come and feed their families as a consequence of what we put on the ground there. This is who we are, and this is what they intended to destroy, because our success in uplifting communities and things like this makes us a negative statement about the government. Because if we can do it with no resources, if we can win white people in this country to participate in giving reparations to the African community through us, so that we can build a basketball court in North Philadelphia where children are accustomed to playing in the streets and don't have any access to anything, which impacts not just reparation, but how people begin to perceive themselves being forced to live under these circumstances. If we can open up a bakery cafe where we're going to train African men and women coming out of the prison system to participate in that industry and then purchase and create a fourplex and actually furnish that so that there'll be a place for them to live while they participate in this African international workforce that we are creating, why doesn't the government do it? And the problem is that because the government wants African people to live the way we live for a number of reasons that we don't have to go into, but the fact is that we do it. And if you look at history, you see that those organizations that's been most involved in changing the condition of Black people on the ground, the Marcus Garvey, with 11 million, but first time in the history of Black people since our captivity, we own steamship lines through Garvey, and they framed Garvey up, the FBI and others, and got rid of him. Malcolm X, who believed in self-determination, Martin Luther King, who was waging a struggle, a poor people's campaign, organizing poor people to take. These are the forces that they attack, and those who are affected, they named the Black Panther Party J. Edgar Hoover, who was the executive director of this domestic political police that they call the FBI. In 1969, declared that the Black Panther Party was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States, not the Russians, not the Chinese, but Black people who are living in housing projects and things like that throughout this country. That's who's under assault now, and we're not going to let them get away with saying that it's the Russians' idea to fight for reparations. It's the Russians' idea to complain about what's happened to Black people and to make economic development happen in our communities. We've always done this. In 1950s, you may be familiar, 1952, around that same period, Paul Robeson and others went to the United Nations talking about reparations. We charged genocide. That was the thing that they took to the United Nations. So somehow, for the Russians to have discovered this and rediscovered through the Russians, it's just so bogus on its face. But they don't expect this to be significant based on some adherence to law. It is the assumptions that's out there about Black people. It's the assumption about the crisis that this country is going through now. It's the Russia, Russia, Russia thing and the absolute reality that the United States is losing its place as the big hegemon, you know, like in the world. Things are happening in the real world. And a lot of people are concerned and made unsettled by this, and they don't have good explanations for it, except for the explanations coming from some mouthpiece of the United States government.
And Hoover, who you mentioned, of course, is heavily tied to the police raid in Chicago that killed Fred Hampton. I'm wondering if that was going through your mind as this was happening to you.
Of course. I mean, that was the thing that I thought they were going to kill me, especially when I walk out the door. Why would they train, you know, not just one, but all of these laser dots from automatic weapons on my chest when I walk out. Of course, Fred Hampton. They went to Fred Hampton's house at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's 5 o'clock now, and they come to my house. And so that's the thought that's on my mind. Of course, Bobby Hutton, who was killed in 1968, I think it was, after King, you know, he was shot a number of times because he came out with his hands up and he stumbled and they killed him. So this is on my mind. I know the history of this government as it relates to Black people, the assassinations, all of this. So yeah, I'm thinking Fred Hampton. That's what my wife was thinking too when she came down the stairs. She remembered Fred Hampton. All of us do. All of us do. And so yeah, that's and you mentioned Fred Hampton and. But, you know, the United States government put together a program to deal with what they call Black nationalist hate groups that included Black Panther Party and anybody from within the African community that was talking about independence, talking about anti-colonialism, et cetera. And the Black Panther Party, of course, is one of them and was the main target, but others of us were targeted as well.
You mentioned MOVE and Marcus Garvey. I knew about, of course, Fred Hampton, MLK, Malcolm X. I didn't know about the FBI and Marcus Garvey, and I want to make sure our listeners and viewers know about MOVE. So could you tell us about the FBI and Marcus Garvey and then also elaborate on what happened to MOVE in Philadelphia?
Yeah, Marcus Garvey was an incredible leader. He was born in Jamaica. He came to the United States. He had built an organization in 1914 that was called the Universal Negro Improvement Associations and African Communities League. He moved to Harlem, New York, sometime around the same time frame of the First Imperialist World War. He built this extraordinary organization of Black people all around the world, including people from India and Australia who were members of this organization. And so was from, you know, up to 11 million members and associates in 1920, they had in New York at the Madison Square Garden Negro Convention, Convention of the Negro Peoples of the World, that was attended by 25 to 50,000 Black people. Before social media, before cell phones and any of this, people came from all around the world. Black people did, and it's the estimate is such this wide range from 25 to 50,000 people, because Madison Square Garden, where the thing was held, couldn't hold all the people. So there were thousands of people outside, massive parades being held there. And this is the meeting where the Black people voted on the red, black, and green. That flag that people see that they mistakenly called the Pan-African flag or some other thing like that. But that came from that meeting where Black people voted on this and said that every nation has a flag and we have to have our own flag. And the red, black, and green came from that. Black people from around the world voted Marcus Garvey at a time where all of us were living under colonial domination, with the exception of the nominal freedom of Liberia and Ethiopia. They voted that Marcus Garvey to provisional president of Africa, and you know, various other instances and instruments of nations of statehood was created by that organization. And what the U.S. government did was, and as I mentioned, they bought steamship lines. This was extraordinary. There hasn't been Black steamship lines owned by Black people or shipping lines since that time. This was an extraordinary move so that Black people could trade with each other from the Americas, Africa, you know, and various other places. So the U.S. government brought its first African into the FBI for the purpose of infiltrating the Marcus Garvey's movement. They needed somebody Black to do that. And you can Google most of the stuff that I'm telling you about, you know. And so they caused splits in the organization, factions, and they decided that Marcus Garvey had used the mails to defraud people. And the mails, of course, were used for people who were buying stock in the steamship lines, et cetera. This was the fundamental economic venture that had been initiated. And so this was attacked. And Garvey eventually was taken to court. He was tried. And he was convicted and sentenced to, I think, 5 years in prison. And he spent some of that time in prison before they expelled him from the United States back to Jamaica. He was an extraordinary force. And like I said, this stuff can be researched relatively easily. And then, of course, the thing with MOVE, where this organization that was called, it was called MOVE, M-O-V-E. It was founded by an African who called himself John Africa. And they, among other things, were environmentalists, back to Africa kind of group living in the heart of the African community. And the government had been attacking them under Rizzo. And you must Google Rizzo, who is the one who raided the Black Panther Party offices. I think that might have been 1970 or something like that, and forced Panthers out in the middle of the winter in their underclothes, et cetera, and with photographers there. So this thing could shoot all around the world and demoralize Black people who had looked at the Panthers as, you know, force that was going to be a part of our freedom and liberation. So Rizzo is the one who did this. When he was chief of police, he bragged about that he had enough troops who could go into Cuba and overthrow the government. This is Rizzo. And so he became the mayor also in Philadelphia, and they dropped the bomb ostensibly to get the people out of the home that was owned actually by a person who was a sister, a relative of the founder of the organization. They attacked the house. This was the second time they had attacked them. They did it, I think, again earlier in something like 1975 or 78. And they attacked the house, and they went and got military grade plastic explosion and a military helicopter, and they dropped the bomb on that house that destroyed 60 some odd houses, killed 11 children, women and men. And that was an outcome of that. And that, again, was in Philadelphia. Those are two of the incidents that you mentioned. And of course, Fred Hampton, who was one of the remaining leaders of the Black Panther Party, who was not in jail, who hadn't been chased out of the country at a time where the FBI had declared the Black Panther Party the greatest internal threat to this country, and where John Mitchell, who was then the Attorney General, had said that by the end of 1969, the Black Panther Party would be destroyed. And so on December 4th, 1969, they attacked the house of Fred Hampton, West Monroe in Chicago. And they, after having drugged Hampton, having used an informant, an agent to put drugs in his Kool-Aid so that he was asleep and couldn't be awakened when they came into the house, they shot their way into the house. They killed Mark Clark, a young man who was on security, and they had a diagram of where Hampton was sleeping. And so they shot through the wall and through the walls with automatic rifle fire. And then Hampton's wife, Akur Njeri, talks about she was almost 9 months pregnant in bed with him. And she talked about how she could feel the mattress vibrating that they were on from the bullets that were coming through the wall, et cetera. When the police finally stopped firing and came into the house, they dragged her out of the bed by her hair and pushed up against the wall. And one of them went, "Well, what do you know? We got a broad here talking about her." And then she heard a voice said that he'll barely make it, talking about Fred. And then gunshots, saying he's good and dead now. And then the Chicago police, working with the FBI, by the way, when they did this, the Chicago police, did that chant like "Fred is dead." You know, it was a popular song that came out of Chicago at the time about drug pushers and stuff like that, and how drugs will kill you. And "Fred is dead" was a song, and that's what the Chicago police were chanting, you know, after they murdered Fred Hampton. So. This is just typical of the war that's being made against our people. And that's just in the United States. That's not the murder of Lumumba, where they cut him up in little pieces. U.S. CIA, who were working for Eisenhower and who was in power there, who was what you call lame duck. And then Kennedy, who was coming in. They murdered Lumumba. They cut him up in little pieces. They put him in vats of acid and then burned it afterwards. And just recently, they sent a tooth back to Congo so that some semblance of a funeral could happen for him. That's what the United States government is doing. And then what I'm doing now and even having this discussion, implicit in the charges that alleged against me, is not me saying, it's Russians saying this through me. And then this is part of this whole trap that I'm supposed to be in, and anybody's supposed to be in, if we're going to talk about what's happened to African people. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
What do you think of the calls? Of course, a lot of Trump fans who said nothing about the raid on your center are now saying abolish the FBI. What do you think of the calls to abolish the FBI?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
Well, Chairman, look, thanks so much for your time. And where can people go again to support your movement and learn more about the African People's Socialist Party?
Well, I would really call on people to go to APSP, Uhuru.org. Also, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, led by an extraordinary young woman who's based in St. Louis, but it's an international component of our movement also. It's having its convention between September 2nd and 4th. And it's going to be in St. Louis. And I would ask people to register, to visit. So it's going to be virtual and otherwise. And so you can go to INPDUM 2022 Eventbrite. And finally, brothers and sisters and comrades, the 14th annual Black People's March on the White House is happening November 5th and 6th. This is through the Black is Back Coalition that we organized. It's comprised of 18 different organizations. That's part of the whole process of pulling together a movement after this military assault that killed so many leaders in the past, and which is another reason that we're a problem. But this mobilization will be happening November 5th and 6th in Washington, D.C. People can go and get more information. Go to blackisbackcoalition.org, blackisbackcoalition.org, and plan to be in D.C. On November 5th and 6th. There's going to be a rally, a march in the White House, and then a conference following that. And obviously, we're going to have to take up this question that you and I are talking about now as a part of that process. So I call on people to join with that and go to APSPUhuru.org, and you can find much of what it is that I'm talking about now. And I want to thank you for having us.
And you also have your O'Malley Taught Me Sunday video series, right, on YouTube?
Oh, yes. O'Malley Taught Me Sunday. I didn't know you were aware of that.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, a study we do every Sunday, and it happens now at 10 Eastern time, 9 Central time, and you can get information on that too through going to APSPUhuru.org. Ask about O'Malley Taught Me. It's a study we do regularly. Thank you so much.
That was great.
That was really informative and a case that should be getting a lot more attention.
Right.
But yeah. Great, we could cover it here.
Yeah, you listening, Rand Paul? Get on this case.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't see it. I think Republican outrage at the FBI is limited to their raids on one guy, Donald J. Trump, not Black liberation activists, unfortunately.
Right. Well, that was a great interview, and we really wish them luck with this case that obviously for legal reasons they couldn't get into a lot of details, but we wish them luck, and we're going to do everything we can to amplify what's going on with them.
And to get more, you can go to usefulidiots.substack.com, sign up and support us there.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, really interesting conversation. You will definitely not want to miss. See you next week.
Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.